Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Allison Stewart, and you are listening to All of It on WNYC. We're turning next to a rebroadcast of our conversation with baker and cookbook author Dory Greenspan. Dory is an icon for home bakers everywhere. For more than 30 years, she's perfected and tested her recipes, collaborated with chefs like Julia Child, wrote 13 cookbooks, and won 5 James Beard Awards along the way.
I'm always thinking about the home cook, the home baker, and sometimes my husband will walk by as I'm tapping something out on the computer, and he'll say, "What are you doing?" And I say, "Well, I'm just trying to get a feel for what the dough is like so I can tell the reader." Mm-hmm. It's fun to work on something with the goal of helping someone be successful.
It's interesting, you're saying people sometimes interesting. Some people will say, "I can't cook, but I can bake." Or I can cook, but I can't bake. Why do people feel like they can do one thing or the other?
You know, I hear this all the time. Or I hear, "I'm a good house cleaner, but I don't like to cook." That's the other divide. Uh-huh. But people always say to me, "Oh, baking, it's so precise. It's like science. It's like math." And, you know, I took science and math for poets in college. So that's not my strong suit. I feel, in many ways, I feel like baking is easier than cooking, because if you have a good recipe, you just follow it. With cooking, you've got all this stuff like, press the flabby part of your thumb, and if the steak feels like your thumb, right? And, you know, I've been in that spot. Steak, thumb, what's right? Baking, if you follow the directions, you're in good shape. And there's also a form to baking, so that once you get the form, you can then, as you do in cooking, play around a little bit. Don't want cinnamon, add nutmeg. Don't want to make a loaf cake, make cupcakes out of the dough. There are people who say they're either or, but I see a lot of overlap.
I think baking might feel more zen for people because there is that idea of, I follow the instructions and it will happen. And so I was interviewing Cecile Richards about someone, the former head of Planned Parenthood, mm-hmm. and somebody asked her what she did to relax, and she said baking.
That's how I started. I started baking because I wanted something sweet, and I was newly married, a college student. My husband had his first job. We were essentially broke, but I really wanted to learn to cook and bake. But it became something that I did after school, after work. It was just coming. And in the end, you had something great to share with people.
You've described yourself as an exceedingly practical cook. What is practical about the way you go about this?
So I've actually become more practical. I call this a soup to desserts cookbook. The last kind of full cookbook that I wrote, not just desserts, was in 2010, and it was called Around My French Table. And it was about the things that I cooked primarily and learned about cooking because I live part-time in France. Since that time, I've been living mostly in Connecticut, where the supermarket is, you know, I've got to get in a car, I've got to get there, go through the 9,000 aisles, come back. It's an hour round trip for a quart of milk. And so over these past 8 years, I have come to rely on all the stuff that I stock on the door of the refrigerator, my pantry stuff. I'm trying to get a lot of flavor out of each ingredient that I'm using, and I'm trying to use everyday ingredients so that I don't have to make that hour round trip. So I've become practical, more practical. I've always played around in the kitchen. I've always followed my whims, and I'm doing more of that and giving more instruction for how home cooks can do that themselves.
It's interesting you mentioned where you live. By the way, we're speaking with Dory Greenspan. The name of her new book is Everyday Dory, The Way I Cook, because you are a part-time Parisian.
Yes, I am.
What is the impact of living in Paris on your cooking?
Paris just stretched my cooking, my mind, I love Paris.
Oh, me too.
So Paris changed me in so many ways. I had access to new ingredients, a new flavor palette, to chefs and to friends who were cooking in new ways. I took all of that, you can't help but take it. It's everywhere. I took all of that, and it's just become part of what I do every day, so that when I'm, my food is not all that different in Paris from what it is in Connecticut. It has a similar style, but it's just much easier to do it in Paris. It's like living here in New York. You just walk downstairs and everything you need is right there.
To be practical, to be able to take this book and run with it, are there certain things a cook absolutely just needs in their pantry already, aside from the ingredients in your recipes?
So there are things that, yes, I mean, just basic stuff. I think about, I mean, for the baking, which is really simple, it's, you know, butter, flour, sugar, eggs, you know, some spices. For the cooking, I love having, as I said, my fridge door. So soy sauce, two different kinds of mustard. I love grainy mustard and Dijon. Just a little bit of that just makes a flavor pop. I have a recipe for gougères in the book, and those are cheese puffs.
This is the first recipe.
Yes, because it's really, if you come to my home, the first thing I'll give you is a gougère. I make them by the hundreds and put them in the freezer. And then I know the doorbell is going to ring, I pop them in the oven straight from the freezer so you can have white wine and gougère. So, and I put mustard in this new version.
Is that why it's new, is the mustard?
Mustard. And I also put toasted nuts in it so that you get the creamy, custardy innard of the gougère and then that little crunch of nut. But I like to keep sriracha. I like to keep gochujang, the Korean chili paste, miso. Just little things that will take an ordinary dish and make it pop.
Bright. Make it a little bright. This is interesting, though. In your book, I thought, oh, I said to you when you walk in, I was like, I'm going to try every recipe. I'm so excited to have something to help me figure out what to make when I get home from work now. Although I saw poke, tempura vegetables, tabbouleh. I was like, okay, wait a minute. This is not so easy.
Wait. The tabbouleh is made with cauliflower, and you can buy the grated cauliflower ready grated at the supermarket.
So easy. Is that part of it? Is finding the shortcuts as well? I mean, just practically?
Yes, but also, you know, some things are, a stew is easy, but you have to wait for it. It's not for you to go home tonight and make it. Poke, if you went shopping, takes, and you had the tuna or the salmon, takes exactly 10 minutes to make. You know, some dishes have such exotic names, or we think of them because we think of them as restaurant food because that's where we've had them. But
it's so funny. I'll share the story with you. One day I made my son something that was it was good. I mean, it was good. And the first thing he took a bite, he goes, "This is restaurant quality food, Mom."
Well.
So funny. I'm sorry. Continue. When you said
that's adorable.
It's like being in a restaurant.
But poke is something that you think of as being a restaurant dish.
Yes.
And it's really all you have to do is stir. That's it.
Just stir.
Mix it up.
Okay. Another recipe I wanted to talk about was your roasted squash hummus. So what is the quality that the roasted squash brings to the idea of hummus?
So what makes it hummus is the tahini and all. But the roasted squash, it's both the texture, which is kind of soft, not quite, it's not creamy. It's got a little roughness to it. It never gets really smooth. But that smoky quality when you roast squash just adds another under layer to the hummus. You know, I love when a dish has a little surprise. There's nothing that makes me happier than serving something and somebody says, this is good. What is that? And you just can't get it. And it's not that I like to stump people, but I think it's interesting to take dishes that we know really well and find a way to make them different, to find a way to make them more interesting so that you're not rolling your eyes and saying, hummus again.
Right. It's sort of a postmodern approach to cooking.
Allison, that's so great.
I do have a question about the hummus, though. Is it technically hummus?
Probably not. Oh,
that's
no.
Okay.
Did I get caught fibbing?
No, that's okay.
Okay.
That's okay. We're talking to Dory Greenspan. The name of her book is Everyday Dory, The Way I Cook. We have one of your recipes on our website. You were kind enough to let us do. It's ricotta spoonable.
Oh.
It's on.
I'm so glad you have it. So I love this recipe. You have it on your website. I have it in my refrigerator.
So for somebody, what is that? For someone who's like, kind of spoonable, sounds so delicious, but what is it?
Yeah, because I made up the spoonable. Right. So it's ricotta that has olive oil, lemon zest. By the way, that's what you always need.
Lemon zest.
Changes everything.
Okay.
And whatever herbs I have around the house at the time. And I just mix it up, and it's something, it can go over, you mentioned those oven charred tomato stuffed peppers.
Mm-hmm.
Love those. That might be my favorite recipe in the book.
Oh.
You can put the ricotta spoonable over that, dip it into it with pita, with raw vegetables, put it on top of a frittata. It is, I love it. It's just an everyday great dish. Well, I'm glad you put it on
the
website.
You know what it's also? I think it's to your Parisian and to your signature, I think it's a scarf. It's a nicely tied scarf. It always dresses everything up a little bit.
Perfect.
Gives it a certain flavor.
we're going to call it the ricotta spoonable scarfable. Well, scarfable would be a funny play on.
Yeah. And I just want to, before we go to break, I do want to ask you, said that the oven charred tomatoes were your...
I love that dish.
Why?
So, because I feel like it's the spirit of the book is in that dish. It's from the bottom up. It's half of a bell pepper. It's got underneath that you never see, but you taste, breadcrumbs with some anchovies and, again, lemon zest and juice. On top of it, half cherry tomatoes, some herbs, olive oil. So it's beautiful when it goes into the oven. It's beautiful when it comes out, soft, charred, smoky, and it can be made ahead. It can be served hot, room temperature, or in between. So it's got that versatility and that little bit of surprise. So it kind of has everything that I love about cooking all in one dish.
You have a great recipe in here called the Lower East Side Brunch Tart that was inspired by a classic Lower East Side restaurant.
It was inspired by Russ and Daughters, a restaurant I love. And I had the typical New York brunch, a bagel that had, you know, an everything bagel with smoked salmon and cream cheese and capers and onions and tomato. And I thought, cream cheese, I've never put that in a tart. I've used it for a cheesecake. Looking at all of these ingredients and thinking, it could make a tart. And it makes a great tart. It's also really pretty. It's the tart that's on the cover of Everyday Dory.
It is great. It's beautiful looking as well. We mentioned earlier, I asked you what staples you need, and you said, flour, sugar, butter for baking.
Yeah.
But you have a section called Basics and Transformers, and something in there called Lemon Goop Vinaigrette. What is lemon goop vinaigrette? What is lemon goop?
What starts with lemon? So, When I'm in Paris and cooking in Paris, I use a lot of preserved lemon, it's a Moroccan condiment, really.
Oh,
it's a lemon that's been cooked it's cured, really, mm-hmm. in salt. And it takes a while to cure. And it's something that I can get on any corner in Paris, but I can't get here that easily. And so, but I love the flavor of that salty lemon. So I made this mix. I chopped up lemon, zest, and, you know, rind in the pulp, cooked it in a mixture of water, sugar, salt, strained it. The syrup that's left over is fabulous in a vinaigrette. It's great in a marinade. The goop that's left over, I whirled in a blender with a little of that leftover syrup, and it becomes a shiny, it's a beautiful color. It's almost like marmalade. And if you put it on your loafers, it would make your loafers taste good. It transforms anything into delicious.
One of the things that's interesting about the book and that I'm excited about to try it out is it's your everyday recipes. These are things that you are letting cooks know that, you know what, just with a little bit of assistance, this is something you can make every day. And we had a conversation off mic that I'd like to bring in about meal kits. You know, they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. They send you the exact amounts, and you put them together, and you hear them on every podcast being advertised. What is your opinion of meal kits?
So, confession, I've never used a meal kit. But I actually like the fact that they're out in the world because I'm like an evangelist for home cooking.
Mm-hmm.
I want everyone cooking at home. And
why?
Because I think it's wonderful to make something with your hands.
Mm.
It's good to know what your ingredients you're using. It's wonderful to be able to make something and then share it. I love the whole process of home cooking, and I take it as a practice in a way. Mm. But not everybody has time to shop and to cook at home. A meal kit lets you make something yourself and serve it to your friends and your family. And I would like to think that that's the gateway to more home cooking. So maybe you do a meal kit a couple of times a week, and on the weekend you cook, and you learn the pleasure of cooking at home, and you continue to do that. So I'm for them.
We're speaking with Dori Greenspan. Everyday Dori, The Way I Cook is the name of her new book. Of course, we have desserts. Everybody knows from your On Dessert column in the Times. How did you decide what desserts? I mean, this could 15 books of desserts you could have.
that was actually the hardest part. Yeah, because I've got about 1,500 dessert recipes behind me. And so the desserts in this book are really pretty simple. There's a new chocolate chip cookie. It's good. It's chubbier and chewier than my regular chocolate chip cookie. They're easy things like poached pears, chocolate pudding. I love chocolate pudding. And there's only one big cake, and that's the cake that I'm going to be making for Thanksgiving. It's the triple parsnip cranberry cake. And yeah, I started to work on a carrot cake, and I made carrot parsnip cake. And the parsnips were better than the carrots, and so I made all parsnip cake and added this cranberry jam that you make in 10 minutes. And it turned out to be, so that's the only kind of project. The rest of the desserts are really like the rest of the recipes every day.
One of the things I thought was interesting, and it speaks to healthy eating, even within the dessert category, was your brown sugar spice cake. And I noticed in the corner it says keeps for 2 days.
Mm.
The idea is you're supposed to eat these food and these whole real foods immediately.
So you can keep it a little longer. It's at its best for 2 days. But here's the way I feel about baking. As much as I bake, I've never baked for myself. I bake to share. And so I also sometimes, when I'm testing a lot of recipes, do something like I'll bake and release. But that's another.
Bake and release. Catch and release.
That's another story. But I think have the cake and share the rest. Don't you think that your colleagues would like some cake? You have the pleasure of baking it. You have the pleasure of eating it. You have the pleasure of sharing it.
Every day, Dori, The Way I Cook. Dori Greenspan, it was a pleasure to meet you.
So great to meet you. Go home and cook.
I will. This is All of It. This is All of It on WNYC. Fermentation is responsible for some of the most delicious food and drink around the world, from coffee to chocolate, from pickles to cheese and salami. But now more fermented products are going mainstream. Rene Redzepi, the chef and owner of one of the most famous restaurants in the world, Noma, has released a new book called The Noma Guide to Fermentation. Let's take a listen to our conversation. So the first line of your cookbook is, "Our story with fermentation is a story of accidents."
Mm-hmm.
What accident?
Oof.
That many?
Oof. Too many, but the best one was we put some salt on some gooseberries, and then we forget about it. And then one time, maybe 6 months later, maybe a year later, I can't remember, one of the cooks opens a jar that's been sitting in the fridge, and he tastes it, and he's like, "This is something." And then he takes a spoonful of this liquid, and he goes all the way to the kitchen, and he says, "Taste this." And in front of me is a murky liquid on a spoon, and I taste it, and it's a berry that I've been grown up with, that I'm so comfortable with. I've had in all shapes and sizes. Yet, for the first time, I'm having it in a new way that I never thought was possible. And it had gone through a lactic acid fermentation. Basically, what we did is that we made a sauerkraut of the berry. And it yielded suddenly this savoriness and complexity that I'd never seen before. And so it was the start for our fermentation program that today, 15 years in, is basically the bloodline of Restaurant Noma.
You've got labs and chief scientists,
yeah,
and chief chemists. And one review described you as a very lovingly as a mad scientist.
So I'm wondering for you, where, when you think about fermentation and you're thinking about creating dishes, where does the science, how do the science and the creativity go together?
Well, they go very much together, actually, particularly in the field of fermentation, because if you understand the processes behind what's going on and the chemistry behind it, it actually becomes easier to innovate. How? Well, if you imagine a fish sauce, everybody kind of knows a Thai fish sauce, right? So that's basically done mostly with salt and some bacteria and a protein, mostly fish. But once you understand that it's the protein that does the magic, then you can replace it. And so we've done it with grasshoppers, which is delicious. We've done it with beef and with chicken wing. So we made, inspired by Thai fish sauce, we've made these other potent sauces that taste different. And that came because we understood the chemistry behind it. So in that sense, it actually, the science and creativity, they belong with each other.
There's this great paragraph I'm going to ask you to read on page 29, because sometimes you say fermentation, people are like, "Well, I'm not so sure about that." So if you would just read this paragraph, and it really explains it quite well.
So there's a thin line between rot and fermentation, and that line might best be understood as an actual line, like the kind you'd find outside a nightclub. Rot is a club where everyone gets in. Bacteria and fungi, safe and unsafe, flavor-enhancing or destructive. When you ferment something, you're taking on the role of a bouncer, keeping out unwanted microbes and letting in the ones that are going to make the party pop. That's it.
So when people are, when you're talking about fermentation, you can you explain to people what you mean?
Well, fermentation is basically, like you mentioned in your intro, it's a coffee. It is bread. It is the transformation of a food with microbes. So that's basically it in its very short form. And for instance, you imagine a grain and you add water. And sometimes you need yeast. And then lactic acid fermentation happens. And then you bake it and it's bread. So the microbes here does the magic. And that's basically what we're trying to do in our fermentation bunker is, through the help of fungi, yeast, and bacteria, we create new things, new flavors that we can use to cook with. And these new flavors, they are like building blocks to us. It's like Legos. Before fermentation, we had a basket full of Legos. With fermentation, suddenly we have 10 basketfuls, and we can build new things, better things, if we, of course, understand how to use them. And a good way to understand what fermentation can do for you in your daily cooking is imagining when you go out and you eat sushi, and you have sushi, and then you watch the chef as he put the soy sauce onto your fish. And that's when it sort of happens. That's the flavor moment. That's fermentation happening. And so if you innovate like we do on this, then you can really, 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 really make cooking fun, easier, and more delicious. And it today is what is the driving force behind our innovation.
You said something in your answer that I can't let go by. Fermentation bunker.
Yeah.
Where is the fermentation happening? Is it quite literally a bunker? Is it a certain temperature for how long? I mean, does it require patience?
Yes.
It takes a while to ferment something, I imagine.
It does. I mean, it used to be in a bunker. We bought some shipping containers and we call it the science bunker, and which became the fermentation bunker. You have to imagine we were sort of very traditional kitchen, having a bunch of cooks trying to figure out how to make the next menu. And suddenly we stumble on fermentation. And at a certain point, we decide, let's take the role of fermentation out of the kitchen and create its own space for it and hire a team of cooks, but also people that actually know the chemistry behind it, and let them run loose and see what happens. And it was extraordinary what happened. And today we have a very sort of, I mean, it looks like a lab, actually. It doesn't look very much like a kitchen. We had a Stanford PhD in chemistry that came to the restaurant. And she was like, "Your lab is better than mine." But ultimately, it's a lab with chambers that are temperature controlled. We can control the humidity. We have all sort of sensitive equipment to measure. But you don't need that. That's not how we started. That's not the beginning of Noma's. We started out with grandmother, you know, a grandmother's heating blanket and a styrofoam container to have a certain temperature. And that's when we started heating things and adding, you know, molds and yeast to our foods. And so everybody can do that. And we also explain that in the book, how to actually create your own lab.
How much did you go back for historical influences and historical input? Because people have been fermenting for hundreds of years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are some people arguing that fermentation is the first sort of cooked foods ever happening when fruit fall to the ground. And you can actually Google Google this, and you can still see animals that eat fallen fruit, and they get drunk. It's really fun to watch that, actually. But obviously, we've been studying fermentation all throughout, and typically the places where fermentation happens a lot is in more cold climate regions, mm-hmm. where people had to process their food to survive the cold winters. So we have a tradition in the Nordics of fermenting. So do particularly places like Korea or Japan. And so we've been studying that vigorously over the last decade. We're inspired by it all. I mean, today our ferments are not driven only by what happened in the Nordics. They're driven by where the best flavors and the best ideas are. And so we've been able to be inspired by that and take ideas that are Japanese or Korean and bring them to Denmark and then somehow make it our own.
We're speaking with Rene Redzepi about his new book, The Noma Guide to Fermentation. There's so much to discuss. You talk about lactofermentation, vinegar, koji, garum, black fruits and vegetables, but you start with fruits in the book, right?
Yeah.
Are they the least intimidating? Is that why?
They're the easiest.
Easiest.
Absolutely. I mean, fruits, they're so easy because, you know, the lactic acid bacteria, they're all over. They're in this room right now. They're on our skin. They're on the skin of fruit. So if you add 2% salt to these, whatever fruit actually, and you let time do its thing, it transforms from a raw fruit into a lactic acid fermentation and it yields suddenly a liquid and a paste. And so, for instance, we've just been doing blueberries because we just came out of the blueberry season. And the paste of the lactic acid blueberries, we smeared them on cooked corn. And it sounds a bit weird, blueberries and corn, because, you know, you can only imagine one way of blueberry. But when you imagine that it's suddenly savory and has umami potency to it, and with the fruitiness to the corn, it's so good.
You wrote, vinegar improves practically anything.
Mm-hmm.
How so?
Well, I mean, an example should be if you have balsamico, mm-hmm. an old one, people know that thick, delicious flavor. You have a drop of that on your ice cream, that's pretty good. But if you have a drop of that on your steak, that's also pretty good. If you have a drop of that on your fish, that's also... If you have a drop of that on your morning yogurt, that's also pretty good. That's a good example of how, once you learn to use these things, that they can make things better.
You write about miso, but also, is it piso? Am I saying it right?
We call it piso, yeah.
I have no idea what that is.
No, well, miso obviously is made from soybeans. That's the tradition. And it's made with rice and soybeans. So we were inspired by the Japanese tradition of miso, but we can't grow soybeans because we don't have enough temperature to do so. But we have peas. And so we tried molding peas and making this paste, and it turns out that it looks very similar to miso, but it isn't because it's made from peas. And so, I mean, we weren't very imaginative when we made the name, so we just call it piso.
It's funny. We're speaking with Rene Redzepi, The Noma Guide to Fermentation, his new book. He co-wrote it with David Zilbert. Now, you mentioned briefly in there, and I want to get into a little bit, that this is also a bit of a guide for people to do this at home. You mm-hmm. want to encourage people to do this at home.
Yeah.
Is there one particular project, as we've been calling it, a gateway fermenting project, the first one that will get you in there?
Yeah.
What is it?
That's the fruit. That's the lactic acid fermentation. It is so simple. You need a jar. You need some salt. You need some fruit. That's it.
For how long? Would I just put it all in there back of the closet?
You put it all in there and you let it stay at room temperature. Typically, I mean, it all depends a little bit. You know, you got to tend to it. Unfortunately, with fermentation, it goes against what's, let's say, popular right now. There's no Instagram quickness in it. There's no quick download. It's an analog thing. You use your hands and you wait. Which is what I really, actually, one of the things I like about it. So in the case of these berries, you just mix it together, put it in the jar, make sure it's sort of airtight, and then you leave it at room temperature, and it typically takes 5 days for it to be really good.
How do I know when it's done? How did you know when it was done? And you would finish fermenting something.
Well, you know, in the book, we have a chapter that explains what to look out for. But I will say it's no different than from when the first time you actually make a bread or the first time you start having fish in your home. And you know when it's not good or when it's very good. It's same thing with your bread. Same thing, it will start to happen with fermentation the more you get into it. You just know. You can smell it, you can see it. The ground rule is if it really smells like death and destruction, then don't.
Don't.
Then don't.
That's a pretty good rule of thumb for most things. Just feeling like death and destruction,
that's
just
it.
Don't.
If your fish smells like that, don't.
Don't.
If your fermentation, don't.
Oh my gosh, that was funny. What was something you mentioned that the oddest thing that you fermented, aside from the grasshoppers, that's low-hanging fruit, that's too easy. What is something that's just even surprised you that the fermentation worked on and it was perfection?
Oh, you say the grasshopper is low-hanging fruit, but I have to bring that out because, you know, it was such a taboo for us. In the West, it is. And I'd come from a long journey in Mexico, and we were eating all these bugs, and they were delicious. And I thought, why aren't we doing it back home? I mean, these people know what's good. We're the ones that don't know. And so we ordered grasshoppers. Turned out it was very difficult, but we had to order them from a pet store. And it turns out when we opened them, they were alive. We didn't know that. So, but when you ferment those in the same way as a Thai fish sauce, what comes out 6 months later is a liquid that sits between a mole, a soy sauce, and a vinegar. It is simply incredible.
Sticking with the grasshoppers. Before I let you go, you wrote, I believe in fermentation wholeheartedly, not only as a way to unlock flavor, but as a way of making food that feels good to eat.
Uh-huh.
What does feels good to me mean?
Well, I mean, let's say you have a steak for breakfast or you have a bowl of yogurt. Do you know what I mean now?
No.
No.
Try again.
Well, there's just something that sits good in your stomach, you know?
Understood.
Yeah, that's it. And if you learn how to use these things that add so much flavor, and sometimes also can help activate your gut, it just sits good in your stomach.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We will be right back. Listening to All of It on WNYC, I'm Allison Stewart. Israeli-British chef and restaurateur Yotam Ottolenghi has a cult following when it comes to his gorgeous and flavorful dishes that reinvent Middle Eastern flavors. In his new cookbook, Ottolenghi Simple, a cookbook, he presents 130 streamlined recipes, all simple in at least one way, made in 30 minutes or less with 10 or fewer ingredients. We talked about the book, his favorite ingredients, and the beloved recipes inspired by his family. Let's take a listen to our conversation. Nice to see you.
Hi.
So your recipes have a reputation for being gorgeous and complex, and you're self-aware to know this. Enough that you know that people say this about your recipes. You wrote in your book, for anyone wondering, Ottolenghi Simple is not a contradiction in terms. I know. I've seen the raised eyebrows. I've heard the jokes. So how did you go about simplifying your recipes for us mortal folk?
Well, to be honest, I didn't really simplify. I just started from scratch. So I sat down with my collaborators on this book, Tara Wigley and Esme Howarth, and we just decided to not take old recipes and try to simplify them or pare them down, because that felt like a compromise. Really, we just sat down and thought, okay, what do we like to do and we can cook easily when we come home from work? And all sorts of tricks and things using canned chickpeas and other frozen peas and things like that. And the conversation just rolled. And in some ways, what I thought was maybe not sophisticated enough for a cookbook ended up being filling up the pages of this book, because it's not so much about paring down recipes. It's about how you cook when you have not that much time to cook or not so many ingredients to cook with. It's weekday cooking, really, is what I had in mind. So the idea for the book, like you said, it's to find different ways in which you can call a recipe simple, because I don't think there's one. What is simple for you is not simple for me. So there's different cooks in this world, and we all have different levels of skill, different anxieties. So when we walk into the kitchen, we bring all this with us. And the recipes in this book are trying to address all sorts of cooks. So if you're kind of a make ahead kind of person, someone that loves when they entertain or have people over to get everything ready and then just toss it all together or warm it up, then you're an M kind of person.
Yes, we should say that the simple, it's an acronym or a mnemonic device. There's, what's S stand for?
S stands for short on time, less than half an hour to cook the recipe from start to finish.
I
stands for ingredients 10 or less. So a short list of ingredients, especially for Ottolenghi cooks, that's very little. The M, as I said, is make ahead. The P in simple is for pantry. So those are the sort of recipes that you cook out of what you got in your cupboard, rice, pasta, you know.
Basics.
Couscous, yeah, basics. The L is lazy. It's not the cook.
Lazy? Straight up lazy?
It's not a cook. It's a state of mind. It's what you do when you put something in the oven, like a roast or a stove or something on the stovetop, like a stew, and you come back after 2-3 hours and it's all ready for you. So you can be lazy or read a book or do something while the food does its own cooking. And the E stands for easier than you think. Mm-hmm. So those are the kind of recipes where you think, oh, actually, I don't make ice cream because I don't have an ice cream machine, or I don't bake bread because it's just too complicated. But in actual fact, there are recipes that are much less convoluted than you think they are. So the S-I-M-P-L-E are all different ways in which a dish can be simple. And many of the recipes are in this book are simple in more than one way. They could be an M and an I. So a make ahead and something that only has few ingredients.
Yeah, it's really interesting. On top of the recipes, they almost look like Subway letters.
Yes.
They have the S M and the I,
it's
or
fun,
the S and
it's
the
colorful.
L. Yeah, yeah. When people tell you they don't cook, what reasons do they give? Are they all those reasons you just mentioned? Or
look, there are people that don't cook, and I never judge people for not cooking. I think it's absolutely fine not to cook, especially if you live in a place where there's a lot of opportunities, you know, restaurants and takeout places. It's absolutely fine. But I think cooking is a joy. And unless you don't cook for the right reason, there's a completely good reasons. Like I said, if you're way too busy, then it's fine. But if you don't cook because you're a bit scared of cooking, or you have never tried it and you think, oh, that's just not for me, I think that's not a good reason. It's a good reason to try. And I hope that in this book I give people lots of, well, 130 odd reasons to go into the kitchen, get the machines out, or even just the knife and the chopping board and get cooking.
We're speaking with Yotam Ottolenghi about his new book, Ottolenghi Simple, a cookbook. I'm interested about make ahead foods. Do they all have something in common?
Well, the thing that they have in common is that you have at least one or two elements within the dish, and sometimes the whole dish itself, that wouldn't spoil over time. So you can leave it either at room temperature or in the fridge for a while. And when you come to serve it, it's as good as it was when you just made it. So if you think of something like, we have got two recipes for meatballs. One is in a tomato, ricotta meatballs in a tomato kind sauce. And the other is are more lemony, and they have celery root and a kind of a really beautiful sharp broth that they sit in. Both those dishes are absolutely fine the next day, even a little bit better. So, you know, so those are the kind of things that you think really there's absolutely no need to stress when you have people over for dinner, because you make that and you can even triple or quadruple the recipe and freeze it or chill it for the whole week. And when people come over, you just put it out there, you steam some rice, and you're ready to serve a perfectly delicious meal. And the one thing that I really think is really important to bear in mind is that one of the things we often forget is that cooking should be fun. And if you've made something a million times before, you're really good at it and you're in a relaxed state of mind. And then when you cook, you're happy and everybody around you is happy. On the other hand, if you cook something for the first time, especially if people come over or you serve
it with
your family.
I wouldn't do that to my friends. I'd have to try it once before they came over.
Exactly. And so this is exactly the right approach. And people really appreciate it. They'd much rather eat something they've had before and you being a happy host than you reinventing yourself as a chef or as a cook a minute before they come.
Oh, a stressed out host is the worst.
It's the worst.
Because as a guest, then you feel bad. Should I help? Should I not?
Yeah.
Why did she do this to her? He or she do this to himself? There are vegetarian dishes in the book, not specifically meant to be vegetarian, where a vegetable, what does it take for a vegetable to be the center of a meal, where it can sustain as a main?
Well, I think that for me, the whole business of start a main course dessert is a little bit biased, because in a sense, I think any vegetable could be as a main, and any dish that has vegetables in it could be served as a main course. It's just about what you serve around it. So in this particular book, I've got, and 70% of the recipes in the book roughly are vegetarian. But if you make something like a stir-fried cabbage with garlic and chili, which is just, I just happened to scroll through the book and find it, but the book is full of them. Essentially, that feels to so many people like a side dish, but it really isn't a side dish. It's a whole world of flavors. There is garlic and chili and onions and a good cabbage. And that served with rice, for me, is absolutely fine as a main course. You don't have to have a clear protein, but if you want to have it, you add a poached egg, which is my solution to everything if you're not a vegan, and there you go, you've got a whole meal. So what I'm saying is the whole people give up the idea of a main course. Any vegetable dish could be a main course or the center of a meal.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. My guest today is Yotam Ottolenghi. His new book is Ottolenghi Simple, a cookbook. We have one of your recipes on our website, braised eggs with leek and za'atar. Mm. Okay, so people are going to think, that sounds, braising does not sound simple. Hold our hand through braising. Hold my hand through braising.
Braising is nothing like we all do it all the time. The moment you put a piece of meat or a piece of fish in a sauce and leave it there to cook, you've braised it. Essentially, it's like a nicer word for boiling. So this is one of my favorite dishes. And, I love eggs for breakfast. But if you want to make a meal out of an eggs for breakfast, you cook them in something else. So many of your listeners probably would have heard of a shakshuka, which is eggs that are cooked in a tomato sauce. It's a North African dish that has become so popular that it's in every possible menu across the land. So this is a green equivalent of a shakshuka. So you take some leeks, you chop them up, you saute them with butter and olive oil, and then you add a bit of stock or water if you like, some chopped up lemon or preserved lemon. And once this is all nice and thick, you break a few eggs in there and some feta cheese. And within 6 minutes, the eggs are semi-cooked and you've got a wonderful breakfast dish that all you need to serve alongside is some bread to mop it all up. So that's all. That's braising in 3 seconds.
I mentioned za'atar. Am I saying that correctly?
Za'atar, yeah.
Za'atar. I cooked with it last night, not because I knew what it was. It was because it became in one of those meal service kits.
Oh, yeah.
It helps me along, helps some of us who Brilliant. Like to cook, but, need a little assistance.
My sympathies.
We're busy with new jobs, so we need a little bit of help. What is za'atar exactly? And if I'm sitting at home and I'm listening to this and you're not in New York City and you're not in an international city, how do I find these things?
Yeah. Well, the one thing I always want to say when people follow my recipes, if there is one ingredient in the recipe and it's not the core ingredient, it's not the cauliflower in a cauliflower dish, very often you can substitute or lose it. And often I offer substitute. So for za'atar, if you can't get za'atar, you can sprinkle some dried thyme or dried oregano, a bit of some sesame seeds and some olive oil, and you're absolutely fine, or even one of the above, not all of them. But za'atar is a spice blend that I grew up with. It's a wonderful thing that is very common. I grew up in Israel, in Lebanon, in Palestine. Those are ingredients that are very, it's a herb that's dried, a bit like marjoram or oregano. It's called za'atar. And when it's dried and crushed, it becomes into a powder. And to that powder, we add sesame seeds, toasted, a bit of salt, and some sumac, which is another local spice. And that is a sharp and spicy and earthy spice
it's
that
delicious.
You sprinkle over anything, really.
Yes. I did it over beef. It was quite delicious. In your book, you differentiate between everyday ingredients and then Ottolenghi ingredients.
Yeah.
What's the difference?
Well, I guess what it is that I love really kind of far out exotic ingredients that throw in a lot of flavor into a dish. And often they're not really always available to people if they're not in the city center or they have a great shop next to them. So those are the kind of the exotic ingredients that I say to people, those are the Ottolenghi ingredients. They offer a lot of flavor for very little work. So the za'atar we mentioned is mm-hmm. one of them. Preserved lemon is another one, which are essentially lemons that have been left to kind of ferment and do their work over time. And then you've got both acidity, but also a kind of a mature lemon flavor. So there's a bunch of harissa, which is a chili, it's a Tunisian or North African chili paste. Those are all ingredients that have a lot of flavor. And what I say at the beginning of the book, I said, those are my 10 ingredients for this particular book. If you buy them, And they're not expensive, but you can order them online or find them in certain Middle Eastern shops. You can have them in your cupboard, and then you can cook tons of recipes from this book. So you don't go out to buy one ingredient for this particular dish. You buy the 10 ingredients, and you can cook, you know, 30, 40, 50 recipes in this book over time. So people won't complain and say, how come I had to go and buy this za'atar and I use half a teaspoon and it sits there rotting in my cabin, in my spice cabinet? No, if you buy it in this book, it will take you quite far.
It's interesting that you mentioned lemons and fermentation, because this week we've had in Rene Redzepi, who has his new book out about fermentation.
And he's
also
a hero.
Dori Greenspan, who talked about lemon goop that she makes as the base for all her vinaigrettes.
She's also a hero.
Yeah, sort of. It's sort of interesting. It's the week of the lemon here.
Yeah.
What is it about lemons in their various states that make them so universal?
I can talk
universal?
About this forever.
You can talk about lemons
lemon
forever?
Lemon is my middle name. So... And it's actually on the cover. I've got a big lemon on the cover of my British edition this book. And essentially, lemons, I think they are so special because, like you suggest, you can go through a whole panoply of activities with them. So for the start, we're all familiar with a bit of lemon zest or skin thrown over a stew or salad and just giving it a nice sharpness, and lemon juice, obviously, which is the juice of heaven. But then when you start roasting lemons or slow cooking them, or even just leaving them with a bunch of salt to start ferment and turn into what we call preserved lemon or pickled lemon, you've got aromatic oils in the skin that over time really mature and turn really perfumey. And this is where I think lemon really comes to its own after it's been left in its own juices with some salt to mature. And then you taste it and you go, wow, that is lemon like I've never tried it before. And there's also dried lemons. If you go to the Gulf or to Persia, you find lemons laid out in the sun and left to dry until they go rock black. And that's the sharpest powder you've ever tasted once you've ground it down. And that's another version of lemon. So really, there's endless options. And so someone who loves playing with food, I mean, lemon is the ultimate trick.
It's also so interesting in different cultures how and what they do with the food and how it then appears in the food. I was in Jordan, and I just remember a family with tomatoes on the roof, just drying the tomatoes. You would go up on the roof, and you could just see all the families had put their tomatoes out. And it was both beautiful, and then you realize, oh, this is going to be part of their meals for the rest of the week.
I mean, tomatoes and lemons are quite similar that you know, they you get quite a lot, and you need to find things to do with it. I mean, it's true about many things, but tomatoes and lemons are very particular. My parents have one lemon tree in their garden, and the amount of lemon my mom gets from that tree is insane. So you constantly need to find things to do with them. So drying, obviously, it means you can, you know, keep on using them for the rest of the year.
You have a dish in here that you call the ultimate family dish, gnocchi alla romana. Tell us about it. Just tell us about it.
Yeah, well, this is the one dish that I can go on and on about, because it's my grandmother was Italian, and I remember very clearly, it's one of those vivid childhood memories, coming into her kitchen and smelling melted cheese. And I knew that gnocchi alla romana, that was what she was making. So gnocchi alla romana essentially is not gnocchi in the sense that most people know, which are potato dumplings. It's made out of semolina. It's semolina that's cooked like porridge with some milk and butter and nutmeg and cheese. And once you finish cooking it, you spread it out on a tray and it sets. And you take circles and put them on a baking tray and put some more cheese on top and put it under the grill until it melts. So it's just the most evocative, delicious, yummy thing you can imagine, which really, it's the dumplings are just carriers for great melted Parmesan cheese. And if there's one dish you want to cook from this book, it's the gnocchi alla romana, because it really kind of captures my childhood and is the ultimate comfort dish.
The name of the book is Ottolenghi Simple, a cookbook. Yotam Ottolenghi, thanks for joining us on All of It.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure.
That's our show. Thanks for listening to All of It. Join us next week, Monday through Friday at noon on WNYC. All of It is produced by Megan Ryan, Rosie Guerin, Catherine Millsap, Andres O'Hara, Joseph Capriglione, and Ursula Summer. Matt Mirando is our engineer, and Luscious Jackson does our theme music. You can follow All of It on Instagram and Twitter. It's the same handle, All of It WNYC.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.